This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, this podcast explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through having conversations with community leaders. Today, we're going to be talking to another leader in Arkansas who works with others in the community who may have differing views from his own.
Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation as we learn how community leaders in Arkansas are helping work towards solutions.
We certainly had a great conversation with Chris Jones in our previous episode, and now we're going to continue with the second part of the conversation we had with Chris. And in the second part of the conversation, he talks about the importance of authentically engaging in dialogue and really being able to hear what Arkansans believe. I think that really provides hope for him for the future of Arkansas, and he provides some suggestions also in the second episode on how we can do that. You know, you were going to be coming in as a potential Democratic governor. We haven't had a Democratic governor in Arkansas for a while. And coming in to hold with a legislature that was going to have a supermajority of Republicans. I'm curious as to how you were anticipating being able to do that, where you're still kind of speaking for the Democrats, disagreeing with Republicans, and still being positive and respectful as a model. How do you, all of that's complex. Thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I think you can be positive and respectful and still be clear and concise in what is right and what is not right. You can be positive and respectful and still be focused on solutions and highlight things that actually are destructive. The governor before Asa Hutchinson, Governor Hutchinson, was a Democrat. It feels like it was a long time ago, but you know, our last governor was a Democrat. So it actually wasn't that long ago. And yet, the last time we had a dynamic where you had a supermajority in one party, in the House and the Senate, and you had a governor of the opposite party, was Winthrop Rockefeller. When Winthrop Rockefeller became governor, it was exactly the opposite. He was a Republican governor, and there was a super majority of Democrats. And so there are lessons to be learned from the way he engaged with folks. Look, a good idea can come from anywhere, and a bad idea can grow from anywhere as well. And so I think it's being honest and saying, hey, you're a Democrat, but no one's perfect. And if this is foolish, it's just foolish and you need to be handled. And similarly, if you're a Republican and you believe that we can increase jobs, have economic activity, and address our climate issues at the same time, then let's talk. Let's come up with solutions. Let's go. That was the approach that I believe in. It's the approach that I would have taken had I been blessed to serve.
I'm wondering about the way that you might see some policies out there that could bring people together. It's admittedly an uphill climb right now, but if we're going to get people together, just as you were talking about, finding some things where people have some common ground where they can both agree to something that addresses some problem we have currently. So can you think of any particular policy or political issues that might be favorable for finding common ground between reds and blues, conservatives, liberals, and so on these days?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. You know, I think about the fact that we can't fully function, much less thrive, in the 21st century economy if we're not connected. And connectedness comes through quote-unquote broadband. And right now, a third of our state is not connected, and really more than that. So broadband, we're in a rare opportunity where we actually have the money. You know, usually there are three things. There's the technical solution, There's the financial resources and there's the political will. We have the technical solution, we have the financial resources, and the people want it. We just need the political will. That is something that we can all get around and say, look, let's get everybody connected to high-speed internet across the state, period. Doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you look like, it doesn't matter. I think that's one. I think the other area is when we talk about education. Let me I'm gonna be political for a half a second and say, like, look, I talked about PB&J. My opponent nabbed that and created Learns. Like, in some respects, it's like she took that and said, all right, let me add to it, let me change it up, and let me fix it. Now, having said that, what that means is there are many elements in her Learns plan that I think are the right thing to do. Now, the way they're doing it, I think, violates the social contract because people need to have time to talk about it. If we're talking about shifting, probably the, if not the largest, among the largest amount of money, taxpayer dollars, to ever be shifted in the history of the state, we need to have debate and dialogue about it. If what does it look like to have pre-K available everywhere? Is it private? Is it public? How do you hold people accountable? What does it look like to require that students pass a certain assessment in order to progress from the third grade? What does readiness look like? Are you saying my eighth grader has to know what her career is going to be, or else she can't progress? Like, these are really rich questions that we have to ask. And what does it actually mean to have vouchers? We have examples in other states. What are the lessons learned from those examples? What does it mean for rural schools? If Ryzen or Fordyce closes, will they end up like my dad's hometown of Hughes? Or if those schools close, will it make the community more vibrant? Like, so I think there are things that we can work together on, and there are things that there's potential to work together on across the spectrum, but you lose that potential when you don't engage authentically. And there's a quote I'll throw out real quick, and that is that I often say the people most impacted by decisions need to be at the table when decisions are made. And so if you do that, then yeah, we can find a lot of common ground. When you don't do that, that's when you see the division and separation.
So how do you set up a process in which we can engage authentically? That dialogue and deliberation, I mean, is that something that just happens at the State House, or is that something that has to happen at the grassroots? I'm curious as to what that looks like or what that might look like.
It's both. It's both. It has to happen at both the State House and at the grassroots. I mean, when you see either party, and in this case, the Republicans are in power in supermajority, when you are saying, because you're a Democrat, you cannot get a committee chair assignment, you can't be on a committee, then what you're saying is I'm locking you out. When you're saying that, yeah, I'll allow the public to speak, but you have to come to me, and you only get 3 minutes, and I'll cut you off when I want to, then you're not authentically engaging in dialogue. Versus, what if there's a massive bill that we're trying to pass? Let's go across the state. I've hit all 75 counties in 30 days. You can do it. You go to every county, you bring community together. At times when single parents can come, at times when shift workers can come, and you say, here's what we're trying to do. Let me get your input. And you actually do it early enough to shift and shape the bill that you're passing. Because the other kind of trick, it's and I call it a trick, it's efficient. But it's efficient when you favor efficiency, then you favor those that are already in power and you favor those that already have the resources. It's efficient to say, hey, let me put all this together, let me bring it all at the last minute. Let me get the folks in. Let me pass it and let's move on. Super efficient, absolutely. But you miss the unintended consequences. And I think the more we say there could be unintended consequences, let's talk about what they are in an authentic way, I think the better the outcome. And the last thing I'll say on this point is that the research shows, and that diverse groups lead to better outcomes. It takes longer, it's messier, but the outcomes are better. So by diverse groups, I'm not even talking about color. You take legislators who are Democrat and Republican, bring them together. You take legislators and farmers. You take legislators, farmers, and teachers. You take legislators, farmers, teachers, and single parents. You take legislators, farmers, teachers, single parents, homeless, veterans. Bring them together because they are Arkansans. And the question is all of Arkansas represented? If you do that, it's going to be messier. It's going to take longer, but we'll be better for it.
So it would be a matter of, you say efficiency. Well, it's efficient in terms of time, but is it efficient in terms of subsequent outcome if you look at it in the long term? And of course, you know, we agree on that, it's not. And I appreciate you bringing the issue up of the research on group decision making. That's something I talk about a lot in terms of polarization, that if you have a lot of the same people, it doesn't even matter if you have the world-class experts all in one group making a decision on something and a variety of people in another group, the folks with the variety of members tend to make better decisions. So that's just really important to understand how we need a lot of different voices at the table to have a better, more enduring outcome for our society.
And Glenn, I saw that firsthand. Objectively, MIT has world-class engineers and scientists. Objectively. This is not something that's, yes, I'm biased, but it is an objective fact. And what I found in my experience, all the years I spent there, is that the times when they brought committees together, where they're all the same, all nuclear engineers, you know, all physicists, they produced outcomes that were less sustainable and less value add than when the institution said, we're going to bring a cross section of our institution together and we're going to work through, do the hard work. And I saw it happen time and time again. So you can have a room full of Nobel laureates and the outcome is less valuable than if you had students, staff, and some faculty members all mixed in together.
That's great. Thanks for that example. Well, let's kind of change the topic a little bit. I want to talk about a little bit of controversy and get your take on it. And of course, our intent is to find some common ground and some ways to look at it that people can, you know, find some agreement on. Critical race theory, that's a current controversy, particularly as it relates to public schools. There's some assertion that critical race theory is being taught in the public schools, even though by all objective indications, it's really more of a graduate level course in law school. But, what I think may be true is that there have been a few instances around the country where some public schools or some class taught something that was maybe a product of this critical race theory. And those kinds of things seem to have fueled a lot of people, particularly on the conservative side, to object to what they call teaching critical race theory in the public schools because they think it amounts to indoctrination or that it makes white people uncomfortable. So, in fact, I think there was even something I read, I think last week or so, about some controversy over African-American history course being taught at Central High. So given all of this controversy and the topic of education in the public schools, how would you differentiate good history being taught in a school system from indoctrination? You know, if we're talking about teaching our kids, you know, how are we going to figure out which is good and which is not so good? How do we form a consensus among our Arkansans about what we teach and what we don't?
Yeah. Well, Glenn, let me ask, how would you define good history first? Let me make sure I'm answering that.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is you would get a variety of experts on the topic history. You would get empirical validation from sources that you have some faith in and reach some sort of consensus there. But not being a history type person myself, that's probably the best I can do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, I think that's one aspect that is overlooked. We assume that the telling of history, if you can tell it a certain way, then that's the true north and it's right. If you differ from the telling of that way, then it's wrong. When in reality, what was assumed to be the true north during my educational experience left out a lot. We didn't have a discussion about the fact that my ancestors were property. What does that mean? What does it mean to be owned by someone else? Now, to your point, it's not taught in our schools. This notion of critical race theory. If we had more time, I would have asked the question of what do you say critical race theory is, right? So we can get a common understanding. But let's just assume that we have a common understanding of that. I think the more fundamental question that doesn't seem to be a part of the dialogue is, why does this get you so excited? What is it about this that you're afraid of? Because fear is driving something. What is it about this that you're concerned about? Let's talk about that. Whether it's parents and Moms for Liberty or some other group, like, what is it that is driving your fear? And then let's also have the conversation about how do we understand what it's like to be the black kid in class and learning about, or the Native American kid in class or the woman in class and learning about things and not see yourself reflected in that. Either reflected through the stories that are told, the facts that are laid out, or reflected through the people who tell those stories and those facts. Because both matter. We go back to the elephant example. If we only have history told by those who are touching the elephant tusk, our understanding of history will look a certain way. But if we have history told by the folks who are touching the elephant belly and the elephant ears, then we'll have a broader understanding of history. And I think, to me, the goal of education is to allow us to see the world through a certain lens, and understanding what that lens that we see it through is. Notice I'm not saying what the lens should be, but just understand that we all see the world through a lens, period. My life's experiences are the lens that I see the world through. Appreciating that, and then knowing my role in this world and the future that I create based on that. So for me, it's frustrating, right? It's frustrating because some folks have grabbed hold of this issue and sucked us into this vicious cycle again. And we're missing the point that there are some genuine people out there who are saying, like, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that my son is going to come home and feel like he is responsible for 400 years of oppression and slavery. I'm afraid that my daughter's going to come home and feels like she's responsible. At the same time, there are folks who have literally been afraid and saying, well, we kind of said that I was property, my ancestors were property, but the way the story was told, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. So, should it matter? Right? When the flip side of it is, I carry around with me a piece of paper sometimes, and it's just a copy of the census record from pre-1867. It's my ancestors. So I don't have to tell you that they were just an age and a dash. No name, no story. And so part of what everybody needs to understand is that for some people in our society, we are trying to better understand how we are connected to history. The Bible has all the begats. This one begat that one, begat that one, begat that one, begat that one. That's a continuous story that links you into the historical record. For Black people in this country, it is a fact that was disassociated on purpose, so that we wouldn't know what our historical link is. Now, once you understand that, you have a greater appreciation of why we need to tell history in a way that highlights that. Not to demonize anyone, not to say you're bad, but to say it happened. And it's why our world is the way it is, and we're all human. So let's create a better society together based on what we know.
The history, this is something that occurred to me as you were talking, that you asked for my definition of history, and I remembered later there's a saying that says history is dictated by the victors. So I guess that gets at part of what you're saying is that depending upon who's in charge at the time and who has the power, then the history, the recorded history, the written record, and the interpretation, the story that's told is based upon their viewpoint. And so I guess we need to have a rich teaching of history that includes minority viewpoints and counter viewpoints, and then let the current people judge based on the best available evidence with a full accounting of all the various ways of looking at what happened.
Yeah. And developing curriculum to get to that full accounting is not easy. Like I taught high school for a year and I just did math. So I didn't have to deal with a lot of other stuff. I had ninth grade algebra way easier than that. And that was hard. But hey, look, if we tell the story of the founding of the origins of our country, one question has to be asked is, where do you start that story? Right? So for a lot of us, the story starts in 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? And he discovered America. For others of us, it starts way before that. And we were here already. And we lived and existed as community, as families, as neighbors. We looked out for each other. We were in pain. We suffered together. We were joyous together. So even knowing where to start the story, like, so let's just admit that the origin date is something that is subjective. And once we at least admit that, then we can say, no, we decided that we want to start it at this date in part because, you know, it's easier, right? Or in part because we have more understanding of that. Like, just be honest about why we're doing the subjective things that we're doing, then we can move forward together.
And, you know, the idea of talking about some of the bad parts, the unsavory parts of our history, I think that's important. Even like if you look at the Christian message, part of what you do as an individual is be aware of when you have gone in the wrong direction, when you've gone off in the ditch, and then be willing to change and go in the right direction. So it requires that self-awareness and the willingness and the humility to appreciate that you might not always be right. So even, you know, Christianity would support looking at both the good, bad, and ugly of our history. So I appreciate that. So since we're talking a little bit about religion, then this is a good time for me to ask something of you that I thought you might have really good insight into. Among the things that divide us are differences between science and religion. And I know that as a minister and a person of faith, and yet someone who is highly trained in science, you're bound to encounter that regularly. How do you deal with that? And what are your views about how we cross that divide between science and religion?
It seems to me that the less we understand, the easier it is to perceive and to perpetuate division. And the more we understand, the better it is to see connectivity. Now, what does that mean? That means that some of the people of deep faith, some of the folks with the deepest faith that I know, that are living out their Christian values on a day-to-day basis in ways that just blow my mind, were some of the most world-renowned scientists in the world. At MIT, which is fascinating, right? Because they go, wait a minute, they're scientists. They're supposed to be diverging. But their ability to say, I can ask the critical question, and I'm actually going to ask the critical question of my religion. And when I ask these tough questions of my religion, then as I discover the answer, or as I discover that I don't have an answer, my own faith is stronger. So for me, it has always been something where I look at the Bible and I see the scriptures and I actually try to believe the scriptures. And God said that the world he created is evidence of him. And as a scientist, I try to understand the what of the world and the how of the world. As a Christian, a person of faith, I try to understand the why of the world and the what for of the world, right? So they aren't trying to understand the same thing. If I can understand the why and the what for, then that positions me. If I can understand the how and the what, then that allows me to move and act. And so I think they're actually super linked. And I would say the greatest scientist of all times is God. And he explained things, he created things, he brought things, like he had there were experiments, right? He did an experiment. He said, look, let's do an experiment. Okay. Again, for me, I believe the Bible stories. You know, God, Satan, having a conversation. Okay, let's do an experiment. You see Job down there? Try it out. That was an experiment. He said, hey, you know, see Sodom down there? Sodom, is there anybody good here? Keep counting. I don't see him. Go again. Try again. Okay. To me, there's not a disassociation. That's just me, though. And I think the more we understand, and I think that applies to so many other areas, the more we understand about people in rural Arkansas, in rural America, the more we'll see them as human and see our connectedness. The more we understand about people in urban areas on the coast, right? There's a mythology of folks who live in places like Boston and DC and California, LA, just like there's a mythology of people who live in places like Mountain Home and Mena and Harrison and Pine Bluff. And unfortunately, the less we understand about those places, the higher the wall of division goes. The more we understand about those places, the lower the wall of division happens. And I think the same is true of faith and science.
What's next for you? I got an email recently that you were starting a new grassroots movement called the Vortex. I'm curious about what you're hoping that's going to be doing and how it relates to the things we've been talking about working across the divide and helping Arkansas and the Arkansans in terms of things that you've seen as you've been on the campaign trail or that are needs. So tell us about what you're doing next.
I've sort of settled into my role as a problem solver and a systems builder, right? And that's sort of been decades in the process of settling into that role. I like to solve big problems. I like to build systems. And in order to do that, you have to sort of identify what the need is and what the opportunity space is. And when I think about where we are in Arkansas, one of the things I see is that we need to do a better job of authentically engaging Arkansans in the process early, in the political process early. So the Vortex Pack is one way to do that, right? So Vortex says, okay, Arkansan, you're concerned about the political dynamics. You're concerned about who represents you. So why don't you nominate your neighbor? Tell us who you want to see as your representative. And so we're going to go about the process of traveling the state and getting nominations, doing some vetting, because the other question is, do these folks align with a certain set of values that you can explicitly talk about? And then provide support for those candidates. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, I think I want to do something to change my community. Maybe I'll run for office. It's another thing for, you know, Glenn and April to say, hey, I want to nominate Chris to run for office. Now when I hear that my friends, my colleagues, my neighbors want me to be there and want me to represent them, that's a different level of support. It also means that we're now listening to Arkansans. So that to me, the Vortex begins to solve that problem of authentically engaging folks early on in the process, because usually people are disassociated from politics until a few months before the election. And by then, you know, whoever's up there, somebody they didn't know, they have to figure out who it is and so on and so forth. So now in addition to that, you know, I've been spending a lot of time looking at what are the other challenges that we face. And for me, again, yes, I'm a Democrat, true and true. And as I said, my color is black, right? So I can pull from everywhere. And I think the only way we're going to get out of this rut we're in Arkansas is to work together, period. You know, we have to work together to get people in office who will work for all of us. And right now we're not working together and we're getting people in office who work for some of us. And I think that's the big picture problem that I and a bunch of others are like, we got to fix this because our future depends on it, right? And I'll leave you with this. I think about the Native American saying that we plant and build today for 7 generations from now. And when I heard that, because I didn't hear it till after I'd done my ancestral research on my family, I thought about the crazy fact that I traced my family back 7 generations in Arkansas. And so I'm asking the question, like, what, when they were struggling and dealing with stuff, and when they were property, what were they thinking about? What were they planting and building that allowed me to be here today? And so that forces me to then also ask the question of what can we plant and build so that our future generations, our descendants, can say, man, they did a great job. Like, we have a better Arkansas because Glenn, April, and Chris work together, despite the fact that they come from different backgrounds. We have a better Arkansas because they said we can have different ideologies, but we all want a social contract that lifts all of us up.
At the national level of Braver Angels, I just got back from a leadership retreat, and they were talking about the need for building a social movement that's beyond Braver Angels. It's beyond the work that we might be doing in our bridge building. And it kind of reminded me as you were talking about that, because I think most of us in the U.S., and my guess is most Arkansans would say, we want to plant and build something that will last, that will be there, that will make 7 generations down the line better, thriving, and being able to figure out how to do that and how to work together on that across all of our differences is really the theme of what we've been talking about. Glenn, anything you want to add?
Well, one of the things, just, you know, I have kind of a thing specifically to Braver Angels, how you see us working in Arkansas to help with what we're talking about, of bringing people together. Now, we have the kind of things that we are already planning to do, but if you have any additional recommendations for us, then we'd love to hear that as well about what we can do here in Arkansas. And then one final point.
One of the things that we did a little of, but didn't do as much as I would have liked, was sort of lifting up the stories of Arkansans. And when I say we didn't do as much as I would like, you know, I'm one person, and people get tired of listening to me, so I can say it all day. But to have mechanisms by which the stories of Arkansans can be lifted up, and by which we can tie those stories back to our commonality, is something that, you know, your efforts at depolarizing are aligned with the notion that part of the way we depolarize is through the stories we tell, the sort of lived experience, the life stories. And I think it goes back to what we talked about, how the lived experience is one thing and the narrative that's told is another thing. And so the extent to which you all can continue to lift up the lived experience of Arkansans, I think that's sort of one major way that we can work together. And then I think the other piece is that the extent to which you can continue to help us, Arkansans, see that there is a difference between there's a difference between calling out negative and denigrating behaviors and policies, and being polarizing. Said differently, a lot of folks assume that the minute I stop agreeing with you, I'm becoming partisan and polarizing. And that's not true. You You can disagree. So the extent to which you can help us understand how we do a better job at disagreeing with each other, how we do a better job at engaging each other even when we're on different ends of the spectrum, I think will be super helpful, and it'll also help us realize that bipartisanship is not the end goal. A better society is the end goal, and bipartisanship is a tool.
Yeah, that's a lot of what we try to make clear to people. We're not trying to put everybody in a happy middle where everybody agrees. It's okay to have passionate beliefs on different sides. What is the overarching principle is, can you continue to engage in dialogue with those people who have different views than you? And can you remain respectful and try to listen to understand what their story is? And that's really all we're asking for. Okay. One final thing then. I want to know what gives you hope these days that things are going to work out here in Arkansas. And if you've got anything else, just throw it in there too. But mainly, what gives you hope?
Arkansans, when I talk to folks of all ages, I think about the little kids I met on the campaign trail that were excited and engaged, and I say little kids, whether wearing buttons or not, that they were just excited to be a part of the process. They were hopeful for the future. That gives me hope. When I think about college Republicans at Wichita Baptist, I met them and engaged with, not right, exactly. I met them and engaged with them, and we're in dialogue now about me coming back to one of their group meetings to have a talk about, like, hey, what does it mean to work together? And when I saw them, when I met them at their campus, I said to them, hey, look, we disagree on the political party, but thank you for being engaged in the political process. Thank you for being engaged and wanting to make your community better. That's what gives me hope that we can actually do something different. Now, something not outside of Arkansas that gives me hope, just because this is a fun thing. There's a kid, a little kid reporter. He was on a TV show out in California a while last week, and he's a kid sports reporter. For some reason, I'm drawing a blank on his name now, but his ability as a little kid to talk about his own life story. And he talks about how when he was five, he's like eight now. When he was five, he had to call and call the hospital because his mom was having a heart attack, and they told him later that she was within minutes of dying. And he talked about the fact that he saved his mom and he wants to make the world better. Like, this is a little kid doing big things. That's what gives me hope.
Well, Chris, it's just been a phenomenal experience. I've been so happy to have you here, and I love the conversations we've had. I want you to continue to do that and spread it throughout Arkansas and beyond.
Appreciate it. I appreciate you all. This is great. Thanks for having me on.
Be sure to check out the first part of our two-part conversation we had with Chris.
When you visit our website, you can help us improve our program by responding to a brief survey, for which you'll find a link on our webpage. You can also email us for program or speaker ideas or other feedback. Just send that email to otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter.
Have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.